for listening to another exciting edition of Frankly Speaking Radio. It's Thursday morning, September 15th, 2005. Welcome aboard, my friends. Quite a bit going on today, a lot of news, and I anticipate a lot of phone calls as well. We have our guest, Dr. Rima LeBeau, has been heard on various programs for quite a while, but pressing issues cause her to make the circuit once again. So it's going to be a good opportunity to talk about things, all things health related, and also to talk about the Codex Alimentarius, big things going on with that, and just big things going on in general. But of course, as is always the case, you guys are more than welcome to play a part in the program today by calling up 1-800-313-9443, toll free and worldwide, 1-800-313-9443. Now, we will take some calls, but we're also going to do some news, so be aware of that. Also, our website is www.franklyspeakingradio.com. You can use that anytime you want. Go ahead and visit, and, of course, while you're there, click on our sponsor, Lee Kroc, and his energy cleaner. His website there, edkuniversity.com. Lots of information. You can send him an email, ask some questions if you like. You can also call him. Two phone numbers posted there on the website. And send us an email as a result of all this wonderful information that you're going to acquire for yourself. Send us an email to energycleanergiveaway@yahoo.com, and we will be sure to get you entered into that contest happening again a week from tomorrow. So almost, every 2 weeks. I'm going to talk about some things today. Mayor Ray Nagin is talking about the French Quarter opening to a certain extent on Monday, just a few days away. Amazing that this thing can happen because they're not nearly done with all the things that they need to do, including the recovery of various bodies, some of which you heard a little bit about yesterday from our caller, Jamie, who, as we mentioned, was just recently out of Gulfport, Mississippi, who saw, you know, the devastation, experienced it firsthand, and has experienced its aftermath. It certainly is not a pretty picture to be painted, and yet it has to be done. There's a lot of things that aren't getting reported on, folks. We told you about this as we talked about Hurricane Katrina as it made landfall. We said, look, this information we have now is only what's available, and what's available is only based on, you know, the hope of some honest on-scene reporting. And we got some of that, and I was pleased to see that. But it, certainly as time goes on, more and more things will be coming out, and there are things that you need to know about and things that we need to talk about. So anyway, I'd like to thank all of you who have been constantly sending me updates via email for various things, and we've tried to stay on top of those as well. But do not discount the importance of what is going on in the Gulf Coast region. It's very, very important. We've stressed that many times. But we're also going to talk about some other things here today, including the UN and sort of the meeting that's going on there, and some interesting developments about the case being made for Iran. Apparently this is something they're going to be talking about here at the UN meeting as this goes on for the next couple days. So watch for that. We never know how it's going to go. Also, Hurricane Ophelia still hasn't officially made landfall, strangely enough. It's sort of been just hanging off the coast there of North Carolina for, I don't know, hours and hours, 48 hours, I think, at this point. So it's caused a lot of rain, a lot of flooding, some damage. But, again, these are all things we'll get into as the show progresses. So we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll check in with our good friend Clint at RBN Studios, hopefully feces-free. And, again, stay tuned. More Frankly Speaking Radio after this. Welcome, my friends. You're listening to Thursday's edition of Frankly Speaking Radio, heard planet-wide on the Republic Broadcasting Network. I'm your host, Frank Whalen. Glad to have you with us here today, as always. And it is September 15th already. Can you believe this? I mean, time certainly flying by. It almost looks like fall outside here, but I think all the leaves that have fallen have mostly fallen because of the severe drought that we've been under here in northwest Arkansas, and probably the entire state, but this is where I live, so that's where I notice most predominantly when I have to go out and clean leaves every day. But we have a significant amount of rainfall that has come down the last 2 days, so it's hard to say. I don't know what's going on, but it's hard to say if we'll be able to stay on the air. Usually the wind blows hard around here and the power goes out, so we'll do our best to try to counteract any sort of technical difficulties. But the guy, of course, who's going to be on top of things, the same guy you'll be talking to if you call into the show here today. 1-800-313-9443. Toll free and worldwide, 1-800-313-9443. Clint at RBN Studios, welcome to the show.
Howdy.
How's it going?
Peachy.
Smell better in there?
Yeah, they're coming to spray some doo-doo be gone today or something like
yeah?
that on the floor.
Is that the official term for it? Or?
Yeah, I think that's actually it.
Wow.
There's a, trademark. Doo-doo be gone.
You know, that might be enzymes. You might want to check that out.
I'm not going to be here.
Oh, well, who cares then, right?
I'm leaving. I'm not going to be around these. I mean, I sat in the doo-doo. I'm not going to sit in whatever cleans it up because that's just probably worse.
It might be worse. Yeah, absolutely.
So you want to hear a rain joke?
Sure.
Why does Snoop Dogg carry an umbrella?
For the drizzle?
For the drizzle.
Yeah. Okay. It's not very funny.
I'm sorry, it's not. Unless you're 12.
Yeah, that's probably hilarious. But I mean, you can't not see that coming, I think.
But just let's see. For the drizzle.
Yeah.
Oh, man. So anyway, something I was going to bring up that
all right.
I found interesting yesterday. You had all these airlines claiming that they need some bankruptcy protection.
Yes.
But I think it's funny. It comes almost to the day, 4 years and almost to the day of when they did it after September 11th.
Oh, really?
Well, think about it. It was like right after September 11th, they shut down these things. These people started going, oh, man, we're getting in trouble. But you know what I mean? It was within a few, give or take, in the grand scheme, pretty darn close. I mean, these guys can't stay open for more than 4 years without having a government bailout of some sort. It blows my mind.
That is interesting. You know, everybody's been talking about the high prices, and I'll be the first one to agree. But from what I can understand, and this could be completely off base, but this is just my personal observation, no fact whatsoever to back it up. But, the wife and I went out the other day, went to this this place called Sodi's, which is it's a very, very cool restaurant, and it's in the old post office here on the square in town. And a very cool building, and sort of keeping with the theme, it's like a soda fountain restaurant. And again, consistent with the theme, they have these little books you can buy, and it talks about various years. And I think they start at 1919 and go up to like 1990. And each book is a full year, and then you look through it, and it tells you headlines from that year, who won major sports championships. Various things like that. Things of significance that would happen in that year. So, if I was to get you something for your birthday, from like 1990 or whenever you were born, then it would have all that information so you could see what life was like before you remember it.
92.
Okay. So, anyway, I was looking at one from somewhere in the 70s, probably my birthday or something like that. And they had they also have these print ads, things that went out in newspapers and magazines to advertise for various products. And they had a thing for one of the airlines, and I don't know which one it was, and it had flight prices, how much it cost to fly, and they were actually pretty consistent with where they are today.
Really?
Yeah, which I thought to be really interesting, because obviously I don't remember flying back then. I didn't fly. But, at the same time, if you've ever flown on, like, a buddy pass or, one of those employee passes, it's like $30 to take a flight.
Right.
So, how much do they jack up the prices? I don't know. I think that if they're taking a hit, it probably comes more from the intrusive security and the I don't know, non-passenger friendly way in which people try to, in which customers get dealt with than it does the prices, gas prices, or, costs to actually, operate.
Well, there's a lot of talk of just extremely, extremely poor management on their half, but I don't know. There are companies that do well. Like, an example, somebody might call in and tell me I'm totally wrong, but if I remember correctly, Southwest Airlines is amazing. I've always had a good experience flying with them a few times. Everyone I know that's flown with them does well. They're profitable. They've never, I may be wrong on this, but I'm pretty sure they've never had any government bailouts or anything like that. I don't know. I mean, maybe it's when you get real big like United and
yeah.
all these other ones that you start having these problems, but I mean, fairly large, and they are really successful as far as. And so, I don't know, maybe they should just use them as a model.
I don't know, but it's certainly a possibility. I know with Delta filing bankruptcy protection again, you know, they're based out of Atlanta, which is where I moved from. That's where I moved from before I moved to Arkansas. And, you know, there are whole communities there, you know, neighborhoods where all the employees who happen to work for Delta all moved into various neighborhoods. And, you know, they said, oh, this is a new neighborhood, and we just got here. And they all moved in and bought all these houses. So who knows how that's going to affect that community, that area, that economy. It could be really devastating. I don't know. I don't know what happens, really. Probably nothing.
Yeah, I don't know. I get so tired of these, like, government bailouts. People are always, oh, you know, the welfare state and all these poor people. The businesses are the ones that really get me, because that's where they lay down some big bucks, is bailing out Amtrak and some of these other companies.
Yeah, absolutely true.
It gets me.
Well, we'll have to wait and see how it goes. I don't know if that would not surprise me if it was almost to the day, but, you know, are things ever going to get better with the airlines? Probably not.
Trains.
You think trains are the way to go?
I don't know. John Madden does it.
What, takes a train?
He drives and takes trains, so he doesn't fly, ever.
I wouldn't fly either. I think I've flown one time since September 11th, and that was just because of a necessity. But, yeah, I would prefer not to fly, honestly. It's not, it does, with all the hassle and the layovers and the security checkpoints and how early you got to get there and all that jazz, pretty much any place I would go, it's about comparable to driving. And at least when you're driving, you got, you know, you're in your own space. You have more elbow room in, you know, a compact vehicle than you do in an airplane. And more leg room, certainly.
And there's no turbulence. I'm not.
Well, you've never driven
of,
with me before, so you don't know that.
I'm not a big fan of flying, man. That midair shaking is, I don't know, I always picture the wings just shearing off and when it shakes. So I get scared on planes.
Do you really?
Yeah,
Do you get airsick?
No, I don't get sick, but when I flew with my wife to Colorado for our honeymoon, I left bruises on her thigh because we had really bad turbulence. I was like freaked out and left fingerprints. It was bad.
You're
a
coward.
I get really frightened midair. But on the way back, I just kind of hit this... I was like, man, I'm totally dead. It doesn't matter. So I kind of hit this state of, like, airplane zen.
Yeah.
I'm just like, oh, well.
You accepted your inevitable demise.
Yeah.
Good for you. Good for you. Hey, you were talking before the show went on. You were sort of outraged by this recent, ruling against... a teenage kid?
Yeah, a 17-year-old kid that hacked into Paris Hilton's cell phone and took all the celebrity phone numbers and posted them on the web. And they give the kid 11 months in jail for it. I mean, it's in a juvenile jail. But he also gets, after that, 2 years of supervised release where he's not allowed to touch any computer, cell phone,
mm-hmm.
or machine that connects to the internet. I don't know.
That's awful.
It's pretty bad.
I think this is the push for cyber terrorism, you know, the idea that this is this horrible thing. If he could do it to Paris Hilton, he could do it to your bank account, Clint.
Yeah.
Except you probably don't have a bank account, do you?
I have a bank account.
Do you?
Yeah.
No, I'm not digging on the banks.
Me if I have any money in it, though.
Well... then why have one, right? Because you're not going to meet the minimum balance, which means they're just going to get you with costs and various things like that.
Have a credit union. Does that count?
I don't even know.
Okay.
I don't know. Well, you know, it's kind of crazy. 17 years old, pretty much a year in jail, and he's got a record now, so who knows what happens after that. You know, sometimes they say these things get wiped off your record. But anyone that's ever had a background check done on them, and I have, knows that these things do not disappear.
No joke. And it's federal charges, so... I've heard for, like, local kind of stuff, you know, sometimes happens, but, I mean, I just think the chances are probably...
Right.
Federal, it's probably staying on there.
Well, you gotta protect the celebrities, you gotta protect the elites, right?
Yeah, I mean, he had also gotten in trouble for a bomb threat to his school before that, so...
Yeah, but they can't charge you for, cyber terrorism and then base it on a bomb threat. Also, so-and-so called it a bomb threat a long time ago.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
I was just talking about it.
Well, yeah, and what was the official charge for?
juvenile delinquency.
Juvenile delinquency, which pretty much, as you said, is such a broad spectrum charge. I mean, it covers just about anything. You know, you're kind of juvenile at times, so I could go ahead and complain, and maybe you'll get charged with that. I don't know. Except, you know, you'd get to sleep in, and I wouldn't want that. Stay with us, folks. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back, my friends. You're listening to Frankly Speaking Radio, our Thursday edition. I'm your host, Frank Whalen, and glad to have you with us here today, as always. Let's dive into some news here, shall we? All right. Associated Press today, Hurricane Ophelia continued its torturously slow crawl along North Carolina's coastline early today as officials feared serious flooding and a possible 11-foot storm surge. Ophelia is expected to turn away from land and into the Atlantic Ocean later in the day after an anticipated 48-hour onslaught of lashing rain and wind. More than 12 inches of rain had fallen on Oak Island at the mouth of the Cape Fear River south of Wilmington, according to the National Weather Service in Raleigh. The Category 1 hurricane had sustained winds of 85 miles per hour Thursday and was expected to dump another 3 to 6 inches along North Carolina's coast. Following the criticism of its response to Hurricane Katrina, FEMA had 250 workers on the ground, a larger-than-usual contingent given Ophelia's size. FEMA also put a military officer, Coast Guard Rear Admiral Brian Peterman, in place to command any federal response the storm might require. More than 120,000 homes and businesses were without power early today in eastern North Carolina, according to electric utilities. And on Ocean Isle Beach, south of Wilmington, a 50-foot section of beachfront road was washed out by heavy surf. Officials on the Outer Banks warned that Ophelia could bring 10 hours of hurricane-force wind to exposed Hatteras Island. Ophelia is the 15th named storm and 7th named hurricane of this year's already busy Atlantic season, which ends on November 30th. So still got a ways to go here, my friends. I'm anxious to see if Al Kupit's Bible code prediction will be coming true, which is, of course, you may recall, that before October 3rd, Florida would get basically wiped off the face of the planet by a coalition of storms. They would sort of band together and form this sort of superstorm that would just annihilate Florida. Interesting to see how that goes. Now, so I don't know what's going on there with North Carolina or what the damage will be. Now, you could say, oh, it's just a Category 1. That's no big deal. Well, Katrina was a Category 1 when it hit the southernmost tip of Florida, and that caused 11 deaths right there. So who knows how much damage. But certainly in this day and age, we have to pay attention to these things. Katrina looks like it will probably cost already the equivalent of the entire Gulf War and the rebuilding process in Iraq. So how long is that? How many years has that been going on? 2-3 years now? So in one fell swoop, we've already at the same cost equivalent, dollar-wise anyway. This one yesterday from the Associated Press. In May, it says, scientists with the U.S. Geological Survey and the Southern California Earthquake Center published a study showing what would happen if a major earthquake were to hit Los Angeles on the Puente Hills Fault. Here are their findings. The estimated fatalities could range from 3,000 to 18,000, averaging about 7,600 deaths. Total injuries could range from 56,000 to 268,000, with an average of about 120,000. The number of displaced households ranged from 142,000 to 735,000, with an average of 274,000. Relief agencies would have to provide short-term public shelter for 42,000 to 211,000 people, with an average of 80,000 people needing short-term public shelter. The amount of debris generated by the quake would range from 30,000 to 99,000 tons, averaging at about 51,000 tons. It says the losses will be greater than those from the 1994 Northridge earthquake in Los Angeles, a 6.7 magnitude quake that caused 72 deaths, because Puente Hills sits under older and more vulnerable commercial and industrial structures as opposed to some of the newer buildings which have updated earthquake building codes and so on and so forth, right? So I've got this one here for you. This is, it's from Tuesday. Knight Ridder Newspapers put this one out. Here's what it says. The federal official with the power to mobilize a massive federal response to Hurricane Katrina was Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff, not the former FEMA chief, who was relieved of his duties resigned earlier this week. Federal documents reviewed by Knight Ridder show. So right there, folks, right off the bat, excuse me. just looking at that much right there. What does that say? All these people clamoring for Michael Brown's head, who got it, were in essence going after pretty much the wrong guy. I mean, certainly he has some responsibility. There's plenty of blame to go around. But it's what you do with that frustration. It's what you do with the outrage. It's what you do with the anger. I think that makes a difference. Do you try to do something good, or do you try to do something vengeful? And then this was a vengeful thing. I don't care about Michael Brown. And again, a lot of people say, well, how could you defend him? I'm not. What I'm saying is it's a waste of energy going after somebody like that. That's just my opinion. Because Brown's out now, and they've got Paulson in now. Paulson, who said at the same time he made his infamous duct tape and plastic wrap comment, that if there is a major catastrophe, that American citizens will virtually be on their own for 48 to 72 hours, 2 to 3 days. So you've got a guy already whose stated purpose before even coming into the position is that he'll wait just as long as Michael Brown did, who's resigned. And again, apparently, the blame should be falling on Michael Chertoff's head. Does that mean that Chertoff should resign? Well, you know, these are appointed positions by Bush. You think he's not going to just put another guy in there who's going to do the same thing? Of course he is. Stay with us. We'll come back and finish this story up and then take a look at Hurricane Katrina a little bit. Stay with us. You're listening, of course, to Frankly Speaking Radio. I'm your host, Frank Whalen, and glad to have you with us here today. Again, this story from Tuesday, Knight Ridder newspapers put this one out, and it talks about Michael Chertoff, Homeland Security Secretary, actually being responsible for the delayed federal response, as opposed to Michael Brown. But here's what it has to say. Even before the storm struck the Gulf Coast, Chertoff could have ordered federal agencies into action without any request from state or local officials. Federal Emergency Management Agency Chief Michael Brown had only limited authority to do so until about 36 hours after the storm hit, when Chertoff designated him as the, quote, principal federal official, end quote, in charge of the storm. But Chertoff, not Brown, was in charge of managing the national response to a catastrophic disaster, according to the National Response Plan, the federal government's blueprint for how agencies will handle major natural disasters or terrorist incidents. An order issued by President Bush in 2003 also assigned that responsibility to the Homeland Security Director. A little accountability, maybe. According to a memo, however, obtained by Knight Ridder, Chertoff did not shift that power to Brown until late afternoon or evening on August 30th, about 36 hours after Katrina had hit Louisiana and Mississippi. The same memo suggests that Chertoff may have been confused about his lead role in disaster response and that of his department. Wrote Chertoff in this memo to the Secretaries of Defense, Health and Human Services, and other key federal agencies. Chertoff said this, quote, "As you know, the President has established the White House Task Force on Hurricane Katrina Response. He will meet with us tomorrow to launch this effort. The Department of Homeland Security, along with other departments, will be part of this task force and will assist the administration with its response to Hurricane Katrina," end quote. White House and Homeland Security officials would not explain why Chertoff waited some 36 hours to declare Katrina an incident of national significance, and why he did not immediately begin to direct the federal response from the moment on August 27th when the National Hurricane Center predicted that Katrina would strike the Gulf Coast with catastrophic force in 48 hours. Nor would they explain why Bush felt the need to appoint a separate task force. Good questions. Again, you know, Bush declared it a disaster area before it even made landfall, so I would think that that would indicate a degree of federal involvement that needed to be facilitated a little quicker than it was. Chertoff's hesitation and Bush's creation of a task force both appear to contradict the National Response Plan and previous presidential directives that specify what the Secretary of Homeland Security is assigned to do without further presidential orders. The goal of the National Response Plan is to provide a streamlined framework for swiftly delivering federal assistance with a disaster, whether it's caused by terrorists or Mother Nature, when that disaster is too big for local officials to handle. The Chertoff memo indicates that the response to Katrina was not left to disaster professionals, but was run out of the White House, said George Hadow, a former deputy chief of staff at FEMA during the Clinton administration and the co-author of an emergency management textbook, says Hadow, quote, "It shows that the president is running the disaster, the White House is running it, as opposed to Brown or Chertoff." Hadow went on to say, quote, "Brown is a convenient fall guy. He's not the problem, really. The problem is a system that was marginalized," end quote. A former FEMA director under President Reagan expressed his shock by the inaction that Chertoff's memo suggested. It showed that Chertoff, quote, does not have a full appreciation for what the country is faced with, nor does anyone who waits that long, end quote, said General Julius Becton, Jr., who was FEMA director from 1985 to 1989. So, there you have it. Very, very interesting stuff, folks. And as we said, it just gets more and more interesting. Ray Nagin, mayor of New Orleans, of course, has made some comments about people getting back into the city. It's very intriguing. Here's what he had to say in the Associated Press today. Although the cleanup will likely take months, Mayor Ray C. Nagin said the tourist-friendly French Quarter and Central Business District may reopen as early as Monday after the Environmental Protection Agency said the foul-smelling air in the city was not overly polluted. I find that extremely hard to believe, honestly. Okay, 80 to 90% of the city was underwater at one time, and we know about the infectious material that was in the water. According to ABC News last week, or maybe the week before, insane amounts of stuff. I think they said 45,000 times the level of what would be deemed toxic, and 2.5 million times the level of allowable fecal matter. Not to be confused with RBN Studios, which is in Texas. But anyway, that's what Mayor Nagin has to say. French Quarter might be open, at least portions of it, on Monday. Nagin said he expects about 180,000 people to return to the city within a week or two when power and sewer systems are restored. Some retailers should be opening and operating by then, as well as two hospitals. Meanwhile, the Coast Guard and other rescue teams continued searching for bodies by boat and helicopter in areas that were still under several feet of water. A few homes in the area bore spray-painted marks indicating that bodies were inside. So the Coast Guard and rescue teams still looking for bodies. Can you imagine that? I mean, as we said, New Orleans pretty much operates purely on tourist dollars. Okay? So the Central Business District and the French Quarter will be open, including some businesses, obviously, that would cater to tourism type of things, be they restaurants or some of the merchandise stores. If you've ever been to New Orleans, you know what I'm talking about. Lots of stores there that sell beads and T-shirts and all kinds of little French Quarter and New Orleans type swag. So these places will be open, and maybe, I don't know. I don't know how well their product withstood whatever level of flooding happened in various areas of the quarter. But can you imagine going to the French Quarter, going to some bars, going to some hotels, hanging out, enjoying the nightlife of the French Quarter while bodies are still being found? I mean, it's repulsive to me, and I don't know. It doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. So the Coast Guard and other rescue teams still looking for bodies. It says the body count in Louisiana climbed to 474 on Wednesday, and it is expected to rise further as state and federal officials went about the tedious task of collecting bodies and identifying them through DNA tests. Says Dr. Louis Cataldi, coroner for the Baton Rouge Parish, he says, quote, it's going to take months, maybe years. This is not going away. So the problem's not going away, and the people are going to be arriving. Now, I don't know, he could just mean residents, but again, if you're looking at a place that operates pretty much through money generated by tourism, they're going to have tourism-related businesses open sooner than, you know, housing areas, for example, because that's how you're going to be able to pay all of your city employees and things like that. And certainly the police have, you know, aside from the offer of some vacations, they haven't really, a lot of them haven't taken any breaks. They're still working. So this is really intriguing. Now, identifying bodies through DNA tests, again, we got to look at that. Because we talked about this. We said a lot of these bodies are not going to be identifiable in any capacity. So what they're going to have to do is find people who say, hey, I have a missing relative. And they'll say, we have to submit to a DNA test. And then what we'll do is have a little disaster DNA database in which they'll be able to match up DNA to the bodies that they find that they can't identify in other fashions. People who don't have fingerprints on file, people who maybe could not afford to go to a dentist to have dental records kept. It says about 40 to 50% of the city is still flooded, down from 80% after Katrina's hit as pumps work to siphon off 8 billion gallons a day. Recovery efforts continued in Mississippi, where Governor Haley Barbour said officials would offer some evacuees room aboard a small cruise ship moored off the Gulf Coast. Barbour called the lack of temporary housing for evacuees the state's largest problem, but he did not provide a timetable or other details about the 490-passenger vessel. Barbour said about 2,000 travel trailers and mobile homes are en route to storm-damaged areas in Mississippi, but most are still in staging areas and fewer than 250 are ready for occupancy. I don't know if I believe that. I don't know if any of you have seen the FEMA trailers, but I've got some photos. Hopefully I can get those to James, of FEMA trailers that have been stacked up in various places and just awaiting for something like this. A lot of them did not get sent down to Florida last year. They've just been in the same place for quite a while. Well, some of them have been deployed, and these things are, you're trying to tell me they're not ready for occupancy? Why are they not? And 2,000 travel trailers is not going to cover nearly enough for all of the evacuees, refugees, displaced persons, homeless people, I don't know, whatever they're allowed to be called these days. 2,000 is certainly not going to cut it, not even a little bit. All right, WashingtonPost.com today. President Bush will call tonight for an unprecedented federal commitment to rebuild New Orleans and other areas obliterated by Hurricane Katrina, putting the U.S. on pace to spend more in the next year on the storm's aftermath than it has over 3 years on the Iraq War, according to the White House and congressional officials. That's a lot of money. The president will call on Washington to resist spending money unwisely, but some in his own party are already starting to recoil at a price tag expected to exceed $200 billion about the cost of the Iraq War and reconstruction efforts. Look, that's insane. I mean, granted, this was an inordinately large hurricane that happened to hit an area where it caused a lot of damage, not just from wind and rain and storm surge, but also from the flooding and the broken levees and all that jazz. And regardless of why the levees broke, it still is factored into this as Hurricane Katrina. So what I'm saying is $200 billion just for a cost of cleanup for this one particular incident. What if there's more? We still have 2.5 months of one of the busiest hurricane seasons on record. It's a lot of money. So it says that some emergency expenditures soar, with new commitments as high as $2 billion a day. Some budget analysts and conservative groups are warning that the Katrina spending has combined with earlier fiscal decisions in ways that will wreak havoc on the government's finances for years to come. Translation. We're screwed. As if we weren't already on an economic precipice, certainly this is not going to make things any better. Not even a little bit. So we need to talk, I guess, about some of these things that are continuing to happen in New Orleans, Mississippi, places like that, areas. This one from yesterday from the Tennessean.com. Here's what it says. An employee was fired from her $7-an-hour job at the Family Dollar store in Spring Hill, Tennessee, after taking some time off to rescue two younger siblings from hurricane-ravaged Mississippi, she says. Kaloni Sims, age 20, third in charge at the discount retail store, said her bosses and a district manager gave her permission to leave. When she got back Monday, after 2 days in Mississippi, Sims said she was told she no longer had a job. She said, quote, I had to get my family. I had to get them. I went and did what I said I was going to do, end quote. Her bosses didn't necessarily object to her trip, she said, but they objected to her leaving work 4 hours early on Thursday and not leaving for Mississippi until late Friday. Family Dollar officials declined to comment yesterday, citing a policy against talking about individual employee situations. I'm sure they did decline to comment. However, a spokeswoman for Family Dollar did say the company is helping employees affected by the hurricane, end quote. Yeah, really doing a bang-up job there. I mean, the best way to help, honestly, it's the best way for all, I guess, all help to originate from, is from a sense of compassion. And obviously they don't have that. So here is what the spokeswoman, Kylie Rollins, said. Spokeswoman, of course, for Family Dollar. Quote, we really have made every effort to support our associates and give them time off when they need the time off and support them with continued benefits and supplies whenever we could. Our associates are very important to us, and we know that this is a very traumatic time. End quote. So that's why we fire them when we give them permission to go and rescue their family. Unbelievable. The day before Hurricane Katrina hit, Sims' father, who lives in Long Beach, Mississippi, told her that he was not going to evacuate. She could not reach him Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday. She says, quote, "I was getting more and more worried. I think I got eight hours of sleep in all of those 3 days. It just stressed me out of my mind," end quote. On Thursday, Sims' father left a message pleading with her to come and get her brother, David, age 14, and her sister, Kendra, age 17. After finding a replacement, she said she left work early to prepare for her trip. Sims got there and found everyone safe, but the storm had been a nightmare. Apparently, rising waters had forced her family to saw their way through the roof of their home, said Sims. Liberty, the family's Great Dane, hunkered down on a mattress, rising with the water that didn't stop until the dog's head bumped against the ceiling. After returning home, Sims called the store and said that she'd be in the next day, which would have been Tuesday. Her boss told her to call before she came in because they hadn't been sure when she would return. Tuesday morning, she called back right before leaving to go to work, and she was told she no longer had a job. Sims said that in her 4 months there, she had never even called in sick. So her father, Reverend Billy Sims, said that this is really unfortunate. He says, "How can Family Dollar be so hurtful? She went to look after her family, and they had the audacity to fire her," end quote. Apparently, she's already found another job working at a gift store in the mall. But still, that's not even the point. I mean, granted, this is the Family Dollar. Now, at the age of 20, she's risen to third in command of that store, only making $7 an hour. But still, it is tragic when you do have stories like that. Much like, of course, the other stories that we've talked about, tragedy that have come out in this, in the aftermath of this situation. Stories like the guy arrested for panhandling in Georgia, even though he had a Louisiana license plate, Louisiana driver's license, Louisiana registration, and happened to have his entire family and any belongings that they had left in their car arrested for panhandling. Much like the stories of the people who have actually said they were hurricane victims to get aid, to get those $2,000 debit cards, people in Arkansas, a couple people in Georgia also. It's a mess. It's a real mess. And there's more stories as well. In fact, I've got one here that we're going to get into after this break. Amazing stuff, folks. This is out of, I think, Kansas. No, it's out of Missouri. And we're going to talk about these people who went down there to help out. They have a very interesting story to tell as a result of their volunteer work to try to help people clean up in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Now, obviously, we see all the things on the news. You say, "I want to help, I want to help." Well, a couple people did. They said, "Hey, I want to sign up, I want to go and help out." And you'll see from this story, things didn't exactly work out the way they had envisioned. And we'll get into that, as I said, when we return here with more Frankly Speaking Radio. Stay with us. Good morning and welcome back, my friends. You're listening to Frankly Speaking Radio, our Thursday edition. Here, I have that story I just mentioned to you. A couple of really, I don't know, just infuriating stories. This is one of them, my friends, LJWorld.com. And it was dated yesterday. It says, what was envisioned as a mission of mercy to help the victims of Hurricane Katrina ended in anger and disillusionment for two Lawrence residents. Instead of handing out food and water to victims in New Orleans, they found themselves under the supervision of no-nonsense, quote-unquote, kind of scary foreman, who had them cleaning up a hurricane-ravaged casino in Biloxi, Mississippi. So they signed up to go and help people. People in New Orleans. And they basically, and we'll get into this, they basically jumped on a bus, and the bus did not take them to New Orleans. It took them to Biloxi, and these people were under the direction of militant, drill sergeant-esque foreman who basically just told them what they were going to do, and if they didn't like it, too bad. Amazing. Kalila Dalton, one of these kids who did this, said, quote, I felt really bad about working on a casino for rich people when there are people suffering, end quote. And then Chris Tucker, the other kid, said, quote, I felt like we got scammed pretty good, end quote. When Dalton and Tucker of Lawrence and others from the Kansas City area said they wanted to leave Biloxi, they were told that there was no transportation for them, and if they tried to walk away from the worksite, they risked being shot by a National Guardsman enforcing martial law. So they sign up for this job to go to New Orleans to help people out. Instead, they're bused to Biloxi, Mississippi, told to rebuild and fix this casino. And they said, we don't want to do this. And they said, well, you know what? Too bad. There's no way for you to get out of here where there's no transportation. You're stuck here for weeks. And if you try to leave, we're going to get you shot. There's National Guard. Hey, can't help it. Sorry, buddy. National Guardsmen, they're ready to go. They're ready to shoot you if you leave the work site. How is that? Talk about work camp. Here you go. Perfect example. And, of course, this is all being chalked up to miscommunication, all being chalked up to a misunderstanding, all being chalked up to a giant mistake, and, of course, we should just look the other way and not even pay attention to this very, very important story. Dalton said, quote, this was a job we couldn't leave, end quote. Representatives for the companies that organized the venture said Tuesday that the matter was all a misunderstanding caused by the chaos and confusion of trying to deal with a massive disaster. Said Terry Hill, spokeswoman for BMS Catastrophe Incorporated, quote, we're certainly sorry that the people had a problem. We're certainly doing the best we can, end quote. That company, BMS Catastrophe, is in charge of refurbishing Biloxi's Beau Rivage Casino. Said Mike Mainsing, representative of One Source Staff and Labor, the firm that recruited the workers, he said, quote, everybody makes mistakes. It was a bad situation. So I hope that makes it all better, because it certainly, I'm chuckling about it, but it's infuriating. That's sort of the cursory examination of the story. I'm going to read the rest of it when we come back. And then another horrifying story that I came across today. Stay with us, my friends, as we head into hour number two of our Thursday edition of Frankly Speaking Radio. Stay with us. Good morning, my friends. Good morning and welcome to your Thursday edition of Frankly Speaking Radio, airing worldwide on the Republic Broadcasting Network. I am your host, Frank Whalen. Glad to have you here with us today. It is September 15, 2005, 7 a.m. here in the Central Time Zone. And, first hour chock full of some big news. If you missed it, go back and listen to the archives at rbnlive.com. Can listen absolutely free, courtesy of John Stattmiller and his generosity. As far as I know, the only person archiving everything on the network and making it available for you guys. Should appreciate that. Also, our website, franklyspeakingradio.com. Also appreciate, please, while you're there, the generosity of Lee Kroc. He wants to see the hits go up on his website. Certainly, you can click on it. Doesn't cost you anything. Read the material. Give him a call. Send him an email. Get yourself some information about what the Energy Cleaner does and whether or not. Find out if it can help you with any particular health situations that you might have. And what you can do, of course, is send us an email. Direct it to energycleanergiveaway@yahoo.com. Send that to us. And you're in the running then to win one of these machines valued at about $1,000. So certainly it's nothing to shake a stick at. And it's very easy to do. You just enter it, and that's all there is to it. And, of course, if you win, it gets sent to you. You don't have to pay for shipping and handling. You don't have to subscribe to anything. You don't have to do anything. It's just an absolute free giveaway. A lot of people don't trust that. Say, that just doesn't seem right. It's right. Our phone number, as always, 1-800-313-9443. Toll free and worldwide, 1-800-313-9443. You can use that at any point today. In about an hour, our guest will be joining us, Dr. Rima LeBeau, and she will be talking about the Codex, which some of you know about. Some of you have no idea what the hell the Codex is. Well, you're going to get an education and have lots of opportunities to interact with her. Now, we will take phone calls here as well, but I am going to get into some of these stories. Finishing up the one that we started last hour from LJWorld.com, dated yesterday. Goes on to say this. Now, this is a story, if you missed the last hour. This is a story about two kids who signed up to help out with relief situations down in New Orleans. They went to, I guess, a staffing agency who was putting together a team to go down there to help out in New Orleans. They signed up. They didn't go to New Orleans. They were taken to Biloxi, Mississippi, told to work on cleaning out the Beau Rivage Casino, which is huge, by the way. I actually got lost in the Beau Rivage Casino one time. That's how big it is. Of course, I think I had a few too many free drinks, but that's neither here nor there. The point is it's enormous. It's very ritzy. And these people were told they signed up not for the money. I mean, I think they paid like $7 an hour. They did this because it was the right thing to do, because they wanted to make a difference somehow. They wanted to help out. So, anyway, they were bused to a different location, to a different state, to a different city, and told to work on this casino. And what they were told it was. And when they said they wanted to leave, they were told by their scary foreman, who were very intimidating apparently, they were told by these guys that, A, there was no way to get them back to where they're from. No transportation available to take them out of Biloxi. And that they risked being shot by the National Guard, who were trying to enforce martial law. Unbelievable, folks. Unbelievable. So, anyway, obviously these people are, you know, relatively unhappy with the whole situation, but... You know, God bless them. They seem to be more unhappy with the fact that they weren't able to do something that they can feel that they helped with. They don't feel like they actually made a difference in anyone's lives, because the place they were told to work on was a casino. And, again, pretty much the ritziest one in Biloxi. But we'll get into the details here when we return. Stay with us, folks. More Frankly Speaking Radio after this. My friends, welcome back. You're listening to Frankly Speaking Radio. I'm your host, Frank Whalen, and hour number two here, 7:08 a.m. here in the Central Time Zone on Thursday, September 15, 2005. Now, we got this story again from yesterday, ljworld.com. It says, it all began when Dalton, age 20, and Tucker, age 23, joined with a couple of other friends from St. Charles, Missouri, and responded to flyers and postings offering $7.50 per hour for about 500 people willing to help with disaster relief cleanup in New Orleans. The postings stated that workers should expect to stay a minimum of 6 weeks and be willing to work 40-plus hours a week, I guess it would be. Travel would be by bus, and hotels, meals, and equipment would be supplied. So, interesting, of course, that they're offering that at $7.50 an hour. From what I understand, people in New Orleans making $10 an hour, but again, they didn't go to New Orleans. It says, on Friday, September 2nd, Dalton and Tucker found themselves on one of three non-air-conditioned school buses headed south with what they estimated to be about 130 people. There had also been a change of plans. Instead of New Orleans, the buses were now going to Biloxi. Dalton said, quote, we thought, okay, they were hit pretty hard, too, end quote. Nearly 30 hours later, about 5 a.m. on Sunday, September 4th, the buses pulled into Biloxi and let the workers out into a parking lot. They were told they could take a two-hour nap on the pavement before they would be going to work. Around 7 a.m., the group was addressed by one of the drill sergeant-like foremen who said they were to march in single file to the work site, which turned out to be the $800 million Beau Rivage Casino owned by the MGM Mirage, where they began clearing debris. During the lunch break, the workers were given bologna sandwiches and a few Oreo cookies, said Dalton and Tucker. Workers were also told that their work days would be up to 16 hours long, and they would be bused to a hotel 2 hours away, allowed to sleep for 4 hours, and then be sent back to work. Tucker recalled talking to Main Singh, who had traveled with the workers, about getting a bus ticket home. Tucker said he was told there were no buses to take them out and that he was stuck there for at least 6 weeks. Tucker said, quote, I just thought I've got to get out of here, even if it is hitchhiking or finding a bicycle, end quote. Main Singh, however, eventually capitulated and obtained a school bus to take about 20 people back home. They left late that Sunday and arrived in Lawrence on Monday, September 5th. Dalton and Tucker said they felt sorry for the people who remained behind. Most people appeared to be low-income folks or with no jobs, and some were Hispanic and could not speak English at all, they said. Neither Dalton nor Tucker were paid for the work they did in Biloxi. So they said, while well, they want to get paid, they didn't do it for the money, obviously. So that, my friends, is a horror story, I think, of a different sort. It's all about exploitation. Bussing in relief workers at $7.50 an hour to clean up 16-hour work days, sleeping on the pavement, the food provided them, bologna sandwiches, Oreo cookies, probably pulled out of a destroyed Walmart or something. And, of course, they're cleaning up pretty much the ritziest place in Biloxi altogether. The other story I wanted to bring up because I think this is important based on a previous story we did earlier today, which is about Ray Nagin, the mayor of New Orleans, talking about the French Quarter being opened on Monday because the EPA, who was doing testings, said that the foul-smelling air in the city was not overly polluted, which I don't know what that means. But Nagin said that 180,000 people will be returning to the city within a week or two when power and sewer systems are restored. Some retailers should be operating by then, as well as two hospitals. But it says, meanwhile, the Coast Guard and other rescue teams continue searching for bodies by boat and helicopter in areas that are still under several feet of water. The body count in Louisiana is at 474 as of yesterday, and expected to rise further as state and federal officials went about the tedious task of collecting bodies and identifying them through DNA tests. According to the coroner in Baton Rouge Parish, he said, quote, it's going to take months, maybe years. This is not going away. 40 to 50% of the city is still flooded. So we talked a little bit about this yesterday with our caller, who was out of Mississippi, and she was talking about the devastation there, and she was talking about the body counts there, and she was talking about how they were basically having to go into Walmart and commandeer anything and everything that could possibly function in lieu of a body bag because they ran out. And she said the reason the death toll was so low is because they have to identify the bodies and then contact the families before they can actually chalk it up as a death, if you will. But again, the coroner there in Baton Rouge Parish talking about how it could take years. Well, we talked about this just a few months ago, that they were saying that 15,000 people had already died in New Orleans, and this was in like April or May. And people were freaking out. And they said, oh, it's because we never actually filed all these death certificates. They've been backlogged for the last couple years. So who knows if we'll ever get a legitimate death toll. And while I'm not clamoring to see huge numbers, I am clamoring for the truth, as always. People need to understand how significant this is. But it doesn't look like we'll get a legitimate death toll, and here's why. This is from the Raw Story. You can find it at rawstory.com. It says, the Federal Emergency Management Agency has hired Kenyon International to set up a mobile morgue for handling bodies in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, following Hurricane Katrina, Raw Story has learned. Kenyon is a subsidiary of Service Corporation International, known as SCI. That is a scandal-ridden Texas-based company operated by a friend of the Bush family. Recently, SCI subsidiaries have been implicated in illegally discarding and desecrating corpses. Perfect person to hire. Louisiana Governor Kathleen, Catherine Blanco is what it says here, subsequently inked a contract with the firm after talks between FEMA and the firm broke down. Kenyon's original deal was secured by the Department of Homeland Security. In other words, it says, FEMA and then Blanco outsourced the body count from Hurricane Katrina, which many believe to be the worst natural disaster in U.S. history, to a firm whose parent company is known for its quote-unquote experience at hiding and dumping bodies. Do you see this, folks? We've talked about it. We said plainly and simply that initially there were huge numbers thrown out, including people from very legitimate sources. Now, I'm not talking about politicians here. I'm talking about hurricane research centers and whatnot. And they said, based on what we're looking at, we figure that there's about 20 to 30% of the people of the population in New Orleans remaining there. And about of that, about a third or so we expect to have drowned in the flooding and in the initial rainfall, which would put it anywhere between, as we've said all along, between 50 and 100,000 people. So then there was this huge backlash. Not the outpouring of compassion that we saw after September 11th. Not the, I guess, the blanket support we gave to our politicians after September 11th. What we saw in the aftermath of this was instantaneous finger-pointing at the federal agencies who dropped the ball, the local agencies who dropped the ball, the statewide agencies who dropped the ball, everybody who had screwed up. And the reason we saw that is because it wasn't instantaneous. September 11th, of course, happened, and it happened for a couple hours, and then it just kept on going as we heard more and more stories. Whereas in New Orleans in particular, for example, after Katrina, we saw situations being they were developing every single day. Every single hour there was new stories coming out about New Orleans and what was going on there. We saw people stranded, people rescued, if that's what you want to call it, from the rooftop, only be deposited somewhere else without food and water and anything else for, you know, going on 5 days at some point. So there was a big backlash against the federal government, the state governments, city governments, and just everybody else involved by us, regular people, upset with the way that the government was handling things and upset with the fact that people are counting on the government to take care of these things. At least that's something I was upset about. But I told you this yesterday and earlier this week and last week as well, that as because of this fallout, okay, that they would be downplaying the numbers. And now it seems that they hired a firm who specializes in that. Let's continue with the story. It says, the Menora Garden Cemetery chain, owned by SCI, desecrated vaults, removed hundreds of bodies from two cemeteries in Florida, and dumped the gruesome remains in the woods, frequented by wild hogs, investigators discovered in 2001. In one case, it says, a backhoe was used to crack open a vault, remove corpses, and make room for more dead bodies. SCI paid $100 million to settle a lawsuit filed by outraged family members to the deceased. A secretary at the law firm that sued SCI over the Florida cemetery scandals gasped when informed that FEMA had outsourced handling of Katrina victims' bodies to an SCI subsidiary, gasping, quote, oh, good Lord, end quote. Peter Hartman, general manager of the Menora Garden Cemetery chain, was later found dead in his car from carbon monoxide poisoning outside his parents' home in an apparent suicide. Yeah, we know all about those, don't we? And because every time this comes up, I feel the need to specifically mention this, I have no intention of ever committing suicide. Just want to go on the record there in case anything should happen to develop. So basically, FEMA and Governor Blanco have hired this company known as Kenyon International, who is a subsidiary of SCI, which stands for Service Corporation International, and SCI is in charge of handling the bodies. And again, lots of experience and cover-ups. You can find this at rawstory.com in case you're interested. But it goes on. Robert Waltrip, chairman of SCI, is a longtime friend of Bush's father, former President George Herbert Walker Bush. The firm's political action committee donated $45,000 to George W. Bush's 1994 gubernatorial campaign. The company also contributed more than $100,000 for construction of the George H.W. Bush Presidential Library. There's more. Quite a bit more, in fact. Stay with us. We'll finish up this story and take some phone calls here, folks. Our number, of course, 1-800-313-9443. Stay with us. We'll be right back. More Frankly Speaking Radio. Thursday edition, and I'm your host, Frank Whalen. Welcome to the show. Got about 35 minutes before our guest joins us, and I'm about done with this story, and then we'll take some calls here at 1-800-313-9443. And that having been said, we'll continue on. RawStory.com has this one about Kenyon International, a subsidiary of Service Corporation International, who deals with bodies. And these people have a horrible track record, and in fact, they've actually been implicated in covering up bodies, desecrating bodies, and so on and so forth. It goes on to say this. SCI also owned 15 funeral homes named as defendants in a lawsuit filed on behalf of family members alleging, quote, macabre mishandling, abuse, and desecration of bodies, end quote, by Tri-State Crematory in Georgia. The lawsuit accused SCI-owned funeral homes of sending bodies to the unlicensed, unregulated crematorium where never-incinerated corpses were found piled outdoors and stuffed in sheds in 2000. You probably remember that story. It was, there's a guy with no fear and no superstition at all. He's got just tons and tons of bodies just laying out in the woods behind his house, and he's okay with that. It seems to me that it'd be more work to just throw them in piles in the woods than it would to actually cremate them, but I don't know. Some vaults, it says, designed to hold one body, each had 67 sets of human remains stuffed inside, investigators discovered. Kenyon bills itself as the world's leading disaster management company. It provided morgue support services following the September 11th plane crash in Pennsylvania and the Asian tsunami. Very interesting. SCI was also involved in an earlier scandal in Texas. Eliza May, former Texas Funeral Service Commissioner Director, filed a lawsuit accusing George W. Bush, then governor, of obstructing an investigation into SCI license violations. May was fired following a dispute with the CEO. I believe he's the CEO. We just discussed him earlier today. Chairman of SCI, Robert Waltrip. So she got in an argument with him, and then she was fired. Waltrip and an SCI lobbyist met with Governor Bush's chief of staff, Joe Albaugh. That name sound familiar? Well, Albaugh, as you know, was later appointed head of FEMA after Bush became president. Albaugh was the one who went right before Michael Brown, who recently resigned. Albaugh left FEMA to become a lobbyist representing Halliburton, among other corporate clients. Surely, my friends, you can see the incestuous nature of this whole process. Disaster equals relief efforts. Relief efforts equal big money for the government. And, of course, politicians, presumably, who were given large, substantial donations, funnel jobs without, you know, competing offers, without any bidding process. They funnel these jobs to their buddies. And you can see how incestuous it becomes. According to Newsweek, Bush stopped by and said to Waltrip, quote, "Hey, Bobby, are those people still messing with you?" End quote. May, a Democrat, sought to force Bush to testify in the case, but in August of 1999, a Texas judge tossed out a subpoena issued by May's lawyers for Bush to give a deposition. So he got out of having any sort of accountability in that area. In 1999, when Bush was gearing up to run for the presidency, Texas Governor Rick Perry approved a settlement for May. SCI paid $55,000. The state of Texas shelled out the balance without admitting wrongdoing in May's termination. Why FEMA chose to outsource mortuary services to a paid contractor is also a mystery to a guy by the name of Dan Buckner. He's co-owner of the Gowan Smith Chapel in the Gulf Port, in the Gulf Coast area. Now, we talked about him. We talked about the story. DeMort is the name of the thing. It says Buckner planned to serve with DeMort, which is Disaster Mortuary Operational Responses Team, which reportedly they told his partner, Gary Hicks of Paducah, Kentucky, to expect about 40,000 deaths from Katrina in Louisiana and Mississippi. So we talked about that story, that he had come on the record and said that. And when he found out that FEMA had now outsourced the mortuary service to a private contractor, who is, of course, charging a lot of money, he was confused. Upon learning of Kenyon's contract, Buckner expressed puzzlement. He told the Shelbyville Times Gazette, quote, "Volunteers would have gone at no charge." Folks, that is a fascinating and an important point. We talked about this all the time. How many different governments, and the answer is over 50, have offered to send various things? They said, we'll send doctors, we'll send relief workers, we'll send this, we'll send that. The only thing Bush took was money. It's the only thing he wanted. He said, we are accepting money, and it can be funneled here, here, or here. And these are various charities who I think are suspect in their level of honesty anyway. So he wouldn't accept any of that stuff. He only wanted money. And, of course, the money used to give is used to be given to some of these evacuees, $2,000 debit cards, which in some places are being taxed. So, again, you look at a little more extra being shaved off the top. And now you've got this guy and his co-workers and whatnot. They said, hey, look, we would have went down there and done it for free. But now, of course, a big industry is making big bucks as a result. And a corrupt one at that. Stay with us, my friends. We'll take some calls when we come back with more Frankly Speaking Radio. Good morning, my friends. Welcome back. You are listening to Frankly Speaking Radio. It's Thursday. I'm your host, Frank Will, and glad to have you with us. Be sure to check the website for information on guests and news, of course, past and present. FranklySpeakingRadio.com. Take some calls here. We got a good 25 minutes to play until our guest arrives, Dr. Rima LeBeau, to talk about the Codex and all things health-related. 1-800-313-9443 is our phone number. Use it any time. 1-800-313-9443. Now, we've given you lots of big news, I think, today to chew on. Hopefully some good insights. Of course, always a good place to start. Alan, Colorado, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Frank.
How are you today?
Very interesting. It sounds like we got Alice in Wonderland going on here.
Yeah.
Absolutely. The fox is guarding the hen house, and it's all about the almighty dollar, unfortunately, not about people anymore.
Absolutely.
The fact that Blackwater is in New Orleans, I can understand them doing private security work for the rich people, but they have no business being, deputized by FEMA. They're not, private security companies are not supposed to be doing general police work. I don't know if you're aware of that or not.
Well, I mean, the point is that they weren't doing that per se. What happened was is they were there donating, quote-unquote, their time. And
I don't
believe
that for a minute.
Well, that's the official story.
That's the story, of course.
Sure.
Yes. Now, Al Martin has just come out with something saying that the Hatch of Utah and some other senator, I forget which one it was, they want to get rid of the Posse Comitatus Act. And this seems to fall into there. We are not supposed to be using the military to do police work.
Yeah.
And this the fact that Blackwater now is doing this type of work, people should be questioning this and screaming. People who understand the way the country was supposed to have been set up.
Yeah.
And we are basically now in a total police state, Frank, and I think it's going to get a lot worse. What say you?
I agree. Wholeheartedly. I mean, I think what you've got here is certainly, just like anything else, it's an opportunity. And when you've got Bush down there at the UN trying to make a case
for Iran.
About Iran. I mean,
yeah.
in the interest of everything else that's going on, he's going to be down in Louisiana tonight making a speech. That is absolutely offensive to me. It should be offensive to everyone. But guess what, Al? People don't care.
Frank,
people do not care. They don't understand these things.
I understand what you're saying, but I think what's really happened is Katrina has only delayed the Iran operation. It's a possibility we may have gone in earlier if this hadn't happened. What are we, two going into 3 weeks now?
Mm.
Roughly almost 3 weeks since two and a half weeks, let's say.
Yeah.
And there's no doubt in my mind that everybody who has a half a brain and who does listen to this show knows that Iran is the next stop. Iran and or Syria is the next stop on the hit parade. And this has basically just been a little delay in their plans, hasn't it?
Absolutely. And people have to understand, just like we talked about yesterday with the general, that, you know, the draft's coming. And he said it plain and simple. He said, if they're going to accomplish their agenda, their goals, which he didn't agree with, but he said if they're going to do it, they need more people. And he said it plain and simple.
About that.
So think about this, Al. You've got hundreds of thousands of people displaced.
Yes.
Now, we talked about the work camps. We talked about the military bases and people living in those types of conditions.
Uh-huh.
But imagine this now. Imagine when you've got the National Guard on scene and they're out there at these various shelters and they're helping out and whatnot, doing what National Guardsmen do. What happens when the military recruiters roll in and say, hey, look, you really got helped out. The National Guard was here. The Coast Guard was here. All these people were great helping
you
out.
We got work for you.
Like
that's
I said.
Right. You're going to be 6,000 miles away, but you'll be getting three hots on the cot, as they say.
Not to mention the fact that they're offering signing bonuses for people. And you get a signing bonus based on the level of experience you have versus the types of skills they need. So depending on what's required, these people could make, you know, $50,000 just for signing up and joining the military. So signing bonuses for the military. Now, that probably won't work, but this is a great opportunity for them to exploit homeless and jobless evacuees from all over the country.
You need a job, hey.
That's right.
We got plenty of
openings. Absolutely. Now, take a look at another thing. Now, stats are coming out about people, and you probably heard me mention this yesterday, that Walmart's in Louisiana are not going to sell guns anymore. Or at least they're not going to sell them for now. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know how long it's going to last. But people are very upset. People who are going back to their homes, they don't necessarily want to go back unarmed. Gun sales have increased in places like Louisiana because other parties like that aren't Walmart are willing to sell guns. But the South in general has, you know, pretty much two times the gun ownership of the rest of the nation.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So here you've got the southern Gulf Coast area annihilated by Hurricane Katrina, and what happens? Uh-huh. A gun grab.
You know, the so-called official body count of, 479?
Yeah, it's BS.
If it's coming from the government, Frank, you know it's BS. The fact that they had 25,000 body bags ready tells us right then and there that that number's way, way low. And I think
you
was it a week and a half ago, you were estimating, what were you saying, 50 to 100,000? I believe you said that.
Yep, and that was based on official estimates, strangely enough, from the Hurricane Center.
Uh-huh.
Okay, these people who specialize in that Ivor Van Heerden individual who was quoted extensively before Hurricane Katrina made landfall.
Before it even hit.
Yes, and he was talking about what they had projected there in town of a Category 5, what that would do. And he said, we have this many people in the city in general. This is how many people have evacuated. This is how many are left behind. And of that, one-third is what we anticipate to have drowned in Hurricane Katrina. And this is like the second or third day afterwards. So based on that, that's where I came up with that number. And of course, you've got Blanco and Nagin talking about hundreds, possibly thousands. Then it came up to 10,000. Then you've got, we talked with one of our callers who said that they had shipped 40,000, I think, more body bags 40, down.
Ooh.
Yeah, and then we've got this story out of Kentucky with this guy who worked for the government's mortuary response, basically, and they told them to expect 40,000. So
the DeMort people's.
Yes. So DeMort was told to expect 40,000 bodies, and that's in Louisiana and Mississippi. So, again,
government is very good in the lying. They ought to open up a storefront and says we provide all the lies you'll ever want. Because that's what it sounds like. Right?
Yeah.
Aren't they good at lying?
They're very good at lying, and they don't give those away. They sell those.
Yes. Well, the truth you have to pay for. The lies you get for free, the truth you unfortunately have to pay for. The fact, you know, you've got one of your advertisers, Christine from BringHemHome.org, which she ought to be doing is telling the people who are going into the military, you're not coming home.
Yeah.
People are going to be shipped. There are a lot of people right now in Iraq, Frank, who, if they come home, they'll come home sick from the depleted uranium or whatever that's over there, or they'll end up, being part of the landscape.
Probably, but
I don't understand why people, you know, one of the things, and I've harped on this continually, we have to get an honest money system, Frank.
Why?
Why?
Yeah.
Because an honest money system, it goes hand in hand with morality. This is nothing but a toilet paper economy. They could print up all the money they need tomorrow to fix New Orleans, and they're not going to do it. It's about control, you know.
Right. But what I'm saying is that if you looked at, before we went off the gold standard.
Yeah.
Right. So you're saying that the country was 100% moral back then.
Oh, of course not.
Well, okay. So don't,
you
I mean.
We have to have an honest money system, though.
There's a lot of things that we need, but I mean, as far as prioritizing, I don't know if that's at the top of my list. I mean, I understand it's important, but I don't know if it's the most important.
Let's put it this way. I can take a rectangular piece of paper and write $1 or $100 on it, and if Frank Whelan accepts it, what do we need the Federal Reserve for?
Very true. Very, very true. You're absolutely right. Something has value because both parties agree that it's valuable. You're right on.
Gold and silver have value, Frank, is because it takes labor to extract them from the ground. They weren't given for nothing. A piece of paper wasn't run through a press and, okay, my goodness, here, Frank, you want that pack of cigarettes? $20.
Yeah.
$5. So now Frank gives Al the piece of paper, and Al gives Sir Frank the pack of cigarettes. It's a terrible, I'm sorry, I'm using a bad analogy here, but you know what I'm trying to say, don't you?
I do, and I think you're right.
I mean,
absolutely.
Why should anybody work for anything, Frank? Am I right or wrong? I mean,
hey, that's what they want, Al. That's the whole point of this. This response is all about, getting us back into a socialistic mindset where we're all dependent on the government 100%, and that's ridiculous.
The fact that these people were being paid 7 hours a day and being forced to work, did you say 16 hours a day?
Yes. 16 hours a day.
That's $112 a day times 7. That's $784, roughly $800 for what, 6 weeks? So $4,800. Plus, they're going to have the living daylights taxed out of them by the time they get done with their check.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Without a doubt. And make no mistake, folks, price gouging is going to be occurring. They're going to say, well, you know, we've got Whoppers here at the old Burger King, but we don't have many.
Yeah, they only cost $30 now, don't they?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know, the whole thing comes down to control, And why don't the people understand that they're being controlled? Frank, the people in this country are virtually working for nothing. Yes, they have a few bucks left over for some, quote, toys, end quote. But those days are going to come to an end, are they not?
Oh, yeah. Well, again, while gas prices have... we talked about oil prices have been going down, and gas prices have remained the same.
No, they haven't gone down.
Right. Oil was going down until yesterday.
I did see $2.92 down in the city. That was sure. I don't know what it is there in Fayetteville right now. It's probably still above $3.
No, it was $2.85 yesterday.
Oh, really? So
yeah.
It came down. It came down considerably.
It came down, yeah, a good 20 cents. But again...
Wow, that wide of them, as
yeah.
They say.
Well, here's the thing, Al. Like I said yesterday, the price of oil started to go up, and they were anticipating the inventory report to show a huge deficit. So that pretty much sort of came to pass. And oil prices, I think, were at 63-something yesterday.
Is that what they are?
That's what they were yesterday. They're 65 today.
So it's a roller coaster. So, it's all manipulated.
It's all BS. It's all BS. But
absolutely.
Again, look at all the economic woes that we have now with all the bankruptcies and whatnot. You've got oil prices are now going up. Gas prices stayed the same, but now they're going to go back up. So I filled up yesterday.
Uh-huh.
It was $2.85 yesterday. Now before Hurricane Katrina, the day of Hurricane Katrina, that Monday, they were at $2.53. Was their gas prices in town?
30 cents in the one day or better.
Oh, they went up a lot. Yeah, I mean it was probably about 310 is the most I saw it here. Maybe like 320. But again, I mean that's a significant amount considering it took several days before the price went up, and they barely came down if at all. But so I got gas yesterday because I knew that today would be higher, and it is. So this is just one of those things.
California right now, California was pushing $4 a gallon in California.
And some places in Georgia was $6 a gallon, and people are still paying it. That's the big problem. Now that's why I said people are stupid. That's really all there is to it. They don't understand.
They don't understand
the implications of these things.
But they do know that as long as there's a stadium in Baton Rouge, the Saints are going to be able to play the big game next Sunday, though, aren't they, Frank?
That's the important thing.
Yeah. Keep up the good work, and God bless, sir.
You too, buddy. I appreciate the call, as always. We got some stuff here. Two quick stories I want to try to crank out, because this is kind of what along the lines of what Al was talking about. About people depending on the government versus not. Okay? This one is, let me see. It's from the OmahaChannel.com, and it was posted yesterday. An Omaha man mowed an obscenity into his lawn, and now his neighbors are upset because they don't want their children to see the nasty language. So the guy had long grass in his yard, and he mowed a two-word curse into his lawn, and now the neighbors are really upset. The homeowner cut a two-word expletive into his front lawn after being warned by the city about excessive grass and weeds around his house. The phrase is about 30 feet long across his yard. Said neighbor Tracy Tunzer, quote, "I saw the neighbor's yard with some derogatory statements mowed into the yard," end quote. Tunzer said she's been hoping her neighbor would mow the long grass in his yard, but she's been upset by the way he decided to mow it. Tunzer said there's a school nearby. Tunzer said, quote, "I have three children, and two of them will definitely know what that says. It worries me. We don't want our children to be around that kind of stuff," end quote. Huh? So two of her children will know what that means, I guess, know what that says. Meaning what? They can read? So two of her children can read, but somehow they're going to be able to read a 30-foot-long, two-word phrase that's a derogatory statement. And I don't want our children to be around that kind of stuff. What are you, crazy? Have you turned on the TV lately? These kids go to school. It doesn't matter, public school, private school, they go to school. That's where kids learn that sort of thing. So she is horrified by this. Down the hill, neighbor Bernie Horstmeyer said he is in disbelief, quote, "When I first saw it," he says, "I saw the big U, and I had to back up just to see if that's what it really said," end quote. Horstmeyer and other residents said the homeowner was warned by the city about excessive weeds and tall grass in his yard. They say the expletive could be his response or just a prank. Who mows people's yards for a prank? City prosecutor Marty Conboy said little can be done legally about the art. He said, quote, There's really no criminal law that covers these kinds of vulgarities. End quote. Convoy said it would be different if the homeowner threatened city employees by saying the expletive, but on the lawn, it is a passive statement protected by the First Amendment. So, if he mows into his yard, Frank you, and that's not what he mowed, that's fine. That's protected under the First Amendment as a form of free speech, of expression. That's okay. But if he said it to city employees, guess what? He'd be in jail. Terroristic threatening. Remember we talked about the letter that was sent? So, writing it on paper is a threat. Writing it in your lawn through cutting it is okay. Convoy said, quote, as much as you might want to shake your head at what kind of reasoning is involved, it's not prohibited. A person who wants to make a statement in public that doesn't invoke a violent response is protected by the Constitution. Convoy said he is, quote unquote, disappointed that someone would use the First Amendment rights in such a manner. City codes dictate that lawns taller than 10 inches can be ticketed, but parks and planning officials said that unless the grass that formed the expletive met that criterion, there is nothing they could do to force its removal. So what they're saying is the lawn, you have to measure 10 inches from where it's cut, I guess, and because that's cut, he's fine. So this guy can have his lawn very long, I guess, as the case may be. But anyway, that one is amusing to me because, again, it's all, we need the government to make him mow his lawn. Boo-hoo-hoo. Stay with us, folks. We'll be right back. Radio, I'm your host, Frank Whalen. Welcome to Thursday. It is September 15th, 2005, 8 a.m. here in the Central Time Zone, and we're going to have our guest with us here in just a minute. You can, of course, read about her at the website, franklyspeakingradio.com. And while you're there, of course, click on our sponsor, Lee Kroc and his energy cleaner. Trust me, you want to read about this, you want to send us an email to energycleanergiveaway@yahoo.com and be involved in the big contest that we're going to be doing a week from tomorrow. Our phone number, if you want to interact with our guest, is 1-800-313-9443. So I got this story, and I think this kind of ties into some of the things we've talked about here in the last couple weeks about self-reliance. Okay? Here you've got a federal judge declaring the resuscitation of the Pledge of Allegiance to public schools unconstitutional. And a lot of people are going to be up in arms about this, saying it's not fair, it's wrong. And the guy who did it is an atheist who said he's offended that children are forced to say the Pledge of Allegiance. Well, as far as I know, I don't think they're forced to say the Pledge of Allegiance. I think it's required that it be read by somebody and people can, you know, speak along with it. But the kids don't necessarily have to stand up, and they don't necessarily have to say the whole thing, and they don't necessarily have to say the under God portion if they disagree with it. But, of course, the kids will be singled out for choosing not to do that, and of course, you know how patriotic, like, the elementary schools are. They just beat these kids up. I'm joking, of course. But, you know, I have a problem with this, folks. I don't have a problem with it being ruled unconstitutional, though, which may surprise some of you. I have a problem with the fact that people feel that they need the government's authority to do anything. That you need to have the government's permission. We need a law requiring people to say the Pledge of Allegiance. No, we don't. And you don't need the government to rule in any capacity for you to recite the pledge. Why do you have to recite it along with all of your other classmates? Why can't you just recite it before you go to school? If it's that important to you, why can't you just say it? Why say it on the bus? Say it in the hallway. Say it to yourself. Say it in the bathroom. Why does it have to be at the beginning of the school day? Why does it have to be in a class? And why do people care so much about something that's ridiculous like this? If you need the government's permission for you to say under God, if you need the government to authorize the school to be able to officially sanction the terms under God being spoken, you are an idiot. Okay? This is a ridiculous story. It's ridiculous that people are going to be flipping out about this. And I'm just telling you in advance. Who cares? Okay? Because let me tell you something. If you believe in God, you don't need the Pledge of Allegiance to affirm that. If you want to just stand up and say, I believe in God and I don't care, who cares? Then say it in other places. You don't need to have permission to do it in a classroom in order for it to matter. What matters is what you believe. And like I said, if you want to publicly affirm your belief in God, do it. You don't need a Pledge of Allegiance to do that. It's much like what we talked about with the Ten Commandments statues out in various courthouses and things like that. People were flipping out, they're going to take our statue! The problem here is that you've got people all upset about a statue. They don't care of the fact they don't seem to mind the fact that the judges and the lawyers and just the court systems in general don't adhere to the Ten Commandments. But let me tell you something, they're pissed if you're going to pull their lawn ornament out at the courthouse. They don't care what it means. They don't care what it symbolizes. They care that it's there, that they have a physical object to virtually worship, breaking, therefore, ironically, one of the Ten Commandments. It's a very peculiar situation, folks, and I don't get it. I do not understand people's reliance on the government for these things. And it comes in every single different form and fashion. We've talked about it many times, talked about the reliance, the government versus reliance on yourself in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. Same thing applies with health, folks. Reliance on the government, reliance on the pharmaceutical industry, reliance on the American Medical Association, or reliance on what you know and how you can take care of yourself. And that's what we'll talk about when we come back. Stay with us. To our Thursday edition of Frankly Speaking Radio, I'm your host, Frank Whelan. Glad to have you with us here on this fine Thursday morning, about 8 minutes after 8 a.m. here in the Central Time Zone, and it is Thursday, September 15th, 2005. Our website, franklyspeakingradio.com. You can read all about our guest here today and link up to her website. And, of course, there you'll also see contact information for to call into the show, and that is, of course, 1-800-313-9443. Toll-free and worldwide, 1-800-313-9443. Very pleased to have our guest with us here today. She is the medical director of the Natural Solutions Foundation and has been practicing all-natural medicine for 35 years. Fantastic stuff. Her website, the same as our guest yesterday, incidentally, healthfreedomusa.org. And we interviewed her husband yesterday. Please welcome Dr. Rima Lebeau to the program here today. Dr. Lebeau, thank you so much. I hope I pronounced your name correctly.
You did a very good job of it, and I'm delighted to be on your show and talk to you and your listeners this morning, Frank.
Well, thank you very much. As you probably heard with my little diatribe there at the beginning of the hour, it just really irritates me to no end the fact that people are always relying, even when they claim not to be, they're still relying on the government to either A, take care of them, or B, give them permission to take care of themselves. And certainly in the realm of health-related concerns, this is a biggie.
It's a huge issue. But in this case, in the case that I'm most concerned with in terms of health freedom at the moment, the issue is not only the government, but the international government, the United Nations, taking away the right to, and this may be hard for some people to believe, but it's absolutely true, the right to clean, unadulterated food without herbicides, pesticides, hormones, irradiation, and the right to high-potency nutrients, vitamins, minerals, amino acids, essential fatty acids, and so on. All of the things that we think are absolutely unquestionable rights. We can take the vitamins we like, we can buy clean meat if we like, we can buy non-GMO food if we like. We think that no one could dare interfere with this, but the world government is in the process and has been, believe it or not, since 1962 of making sure that the only thing you can have is food which has been adulterated and nutrients which have been designed intentionally to have no impact on you in any way. That's what's in store for people. Mm. And let me say, I'm sorry.
No, I'm just, commenting on that. That's it's awful because I think, for the most part, a lot of people don't even know about this stuff.
Well, there's been a press blackout. We have a lapdog press. We don't have a free press. We have a very expensive press. The amount of pharmaceutical advertising that's used to buy the press, the amount of oil influence, the amount of multinational industrial money and influence that buys the press means that we have, as I said, a lapdog press that has left one of the great stories of this century and the last century go not only uncovered but hidden. I don't mean uncovered as the cover thrown back. I mean nobody's covering it because there's too much money involved. Let me give your listeners a little bit of background on Codex Alimentarius.
Okay.
And I'll spell it for you. C-O-D-E-X ALIMENPARIUS. Now, it sounds like an intestinal parasite. It's not. Codex Alimentarius is Latin for food rules. And indeed, food does rule. Those who can control the food supply control history. There's nothing new about trying to control the food supply. What's new is that the way the food supply is being controlled is not for consumer protection, it is for corporate protection. May I give your listeners a little bit of background about Codex?
Please.
Well, in 1962, the United Nations decided to set up a trade commission. Now, remember that. That's very important. Codex was never anything other than a trade commission set up to control the international movement of food. There's a huge amount of money in food. It's one of the big industries. Not the biggest. The pharmaceutical industry is the biggest, but we'll get to how they're related. So the United Nations decided to set up a commission to control the international movement of food. Why? Well, at least the face that they gave it was an altruistic one, and the understanding of the time seemed to be that if people had abundant food, they'd be less likely to fight, and if they had an even share of the abundant food, then they wouldn't attack other people to get it. So well-fed people would be more peaceful people. And that sounds pretty logical until you consider some of the things that we'll get to in a little while. But let's give them the benefit of the doubt. Let's say it was altruistic.
Okay,
so they decided that what they needed were rules to control the quality, the contents, the shape, the taste, the flavor, every aspect of food, and also how much adulterant could be in the food. In other words, how much pesticide could you use? How much herbicide could you use? How many industrial toxins could you have in the food and still have it be acceptable? And that makes some kind of sense, I guess. I don't agree that you need to have tight control of the international movement of food, but hey, I'm not the United Nations. I see things differently. I believe in freedom, liberty, and autonomy. They don't. So anyway, fast forward until 1994, when the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, turned into the World Trade Organization, which was fast-tracked and signed into law here in the United States by Bill Clinton. Not a good act. The World Trade Organization takes away our sovereignty in a number of ways, and perhaps you've talked about that on your show. I don't imagine, from what I know about you, Frank, that you'd be a very big supporter of the World Trade Organization.
No, ma'am.
So the World Trade Organization has a very interesting system of dispute resolution in which if you and I were countries, and you took me into dispute resolution because you said that I had set up a barrier to trade, and the World Trade Organization said, you know, Rima country, you're wrong. Frank country is correct. So we're going to assess annual trade sanctions until you get your act in order of, let's say, $1 billion a year. And then the World Trade Organization dispute resolution turns to you, Frank country, and says, okay, where do you want to impose these billion-dollar sanctions? Where can you do the most economic damage to the country that lost the dispute resolution process? Now, you pick whatever economic sectors you like to smash country B, to smash Rima country that has just lost the dispute resolution process. That's a pretty bad idea. Well, there's an even worse idea. And that is, if a country is Codex compliant, that means if the Codex rules and standards have been enacted as the laws of that country, and another country is not Codex compliant, let's say Frank country has made Codex its domestic laws, in spite of the fact that it's dreadfully dangerous to do so in terms of public health and disease. But let's say Frank Country has done that and Rima Country has not. Then when Frank Country brings Rima Country into the dispute resolution process,